Okay, so I'm going to talk about the harmony of scattering amplitudes from quantum chromodynamics to gravity. So scattering amplitudes have always been important in quantum field theory, but I think now they're becoming even more important, or people are paying much more attention to them, and a lot of this has to do with the excitement over the coming of the LHC. People are waiting for the new discoveries, and these discoveries are of course done through scattering. You need to scatter something and build some huge detector. This is the Atlas detector. Now, what I'm going to talk about is not completely about the experiments and about the directly related to these experiments, but it's kind of the harmony between the theories which are directly related to the experiments, and I will explain about how these ideas are important for these experiments, but the harmony between QCD, gravity, and supersymmetric gauge theory. So this is a basic outline. So first, I'm going to just tell you a little bit about Feynman diagrams. For those of you who aren't experts in particle theory. The Feynman diagrams are, of course, the basic tool. They're very systematic. You sit down and you can just calculate anything in principle, but it does have this problem that it obscures the harmony. When you look at the expressions you get, you don't see very much except very complicated expressions. But with the modern ideas, we can greatly clarify what's going on with the scattering amplitudes and see structures between these three theories that are just unbelievable if you were thinking about the Feynman diagrams. But all this nice stuff, okay, you say, very good, but what can you do with it? That's, of course, an absolutely key question in any kind of theory. You need applications. So that's what I'll talk about, three applications of these ideas. One will be to LHC physics. The other will be to string theory, the ADS-CFT correspondence, and then a basic question in quantum gravity, having to do with whether you can build a theory of quantum gravity, a point-like theory of quantum gravity that's finite. So in graduate school, very quickly you learn about Feynman diagrams. They're wonderful because of the completely systematic way that you can build any scattering amplitude. If I want to understand, see how these gluons scatter, I have a set of rules, there's a propagator, and I have these vertices. These rules are specified in the back of all the textbooks, and then you, after some amount of practice, you can in principle calculate anything, assuming that this coupling constant here is small enough, then we can use the perturbation theory. Now, in practice, life gets pretty complicated pretty quickly, especially if you start thinking about a strongly interacting theory like quantum chromodynamics. There's all sorts of conceptual issues, well, asymptotic freedom, of course, which is why we can use the perturbation theory, but there's problems of many scales, strong coupling, something called infrared safety. It turns out that some quantities that you compute just don't make any sense, non-perturbative contributions, and so on and so forth. I won't talk about any of this. I'm going to just talk about something simpler. I just want to calculate the scattering amplitude. I just want to evaluate these Feynman diagrams. The Feynman rules tell me in principle everything, but the question is, in practice, how can I see what's going on? Now, you say, okay, but what's the problem? Well, let me just show you one example of a problem that happens very quickly. So this is an example which is child's play for the people who do this for a living. So if I went to some of my friends and I said, I need to know the value of this integral, this is a Feynman integral with the Feynman propagators in here, I just need to know this. Can you do it for me? So they'd wake up in the morning before breakfast, they would give you the answer. But let's see what happens if you do it. This is what happens. So this is the answer written in terms of a basis of simpler integrals. You see these little gaps here. So there's a collection of coefficients, and then right in front, someplace over there, is an integral. So this is a rewriting of this, what's called a tensor integral, in terms of simpler integrals. Now, okay, this is pretty bad. This is essentially the very simplest process you could think of, a 2-to-2 scattering, and this is what happened to you. Clearly, this is not good. There has to be a better way. Now, let's look at the state of the art. So, 1948, Schwinger computed the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron. It's this three-point function at one loop. Right? Now we go 60 years later, and we're so strong, we have big computers, we're so smart, and here's where we are. Two more legs than Feynman, than Schwinger. Two more legs than Schwinger. Okay, and there's no complete six-point calculation, so there's no 2-to-4 scattering. And this is not because people are lazy or because... It's because the problem gets very, very hard, especially if you want stable numbers. So the problem you run into always is numerical stability and speed. So if you had all the world's computers at your disposal, can you do this calculation? And the answer, if you try with Feynman diagrams that people have repeatedly tried, the answer has always been no. No one has done it. Now, at two loops, what happens is the state of the art. So if you increase the number of loops, the number of legs goes down. So, okay, so here we have one more leg and one more loop compared to Schwinger.
Just clarify one small thing for me. I'm from the field of astrophysics, not from your field. But why, when you're confronted with a complexity problem like this in other fields, you just say, hell, build a big computer and solve it.
There is no computer big enough in the world to do this by brute force. What you need is some ideas. And that's what I'm going to talk about. Now, big computers are really important. I mean, don't get me wrong about this. Okay?
You're talking about analytic structure, so you get... insight.
Yes, you need the insight to crack this problem, and that's what I'm going to talk about. The insight to crack... Now, look, one idea is worth 100,000 computers, if you got the right idea, right? Now, it doesn't mean that you wouldn't want 100,000 computers.
I see your point.
Could you address one more elementary question? I thought you were going to discuss the combinatorial explosion and the number of diagrams, but apparently, even if you fix one diagram, the interface...
Yeah, it's the problem fundamentally turns out to be not the problem of the number of diagrams, because that you can solve by getting a very large number of computers. The problem is just one diagram. The very worst diagram is deadly.
So can you explain just qualitatively why such difficult integrals as that result from?
Well, just take this this one The reason why it happens, I'll explain a little bit, give you a little more insight. But you can see the problem. This is, in a sense, a trivial integral. This is nothing. If you start making it a little more complicated, and this is what already happened to you, then you see you have a serious problem, right? You know, it's basically a problem of money. You don't have enough money to buy a computer big enough to store a result of doing, let's say, an integral that was a six-point integral with another two. That would be an...
Could you just say what all those terms that are too small for me to read on the next slide?
These terms here are dot products of momenta. So you see there's these indices here. This guy here is
in terms of the tensor.
Yeah, it's just the number of terms. So every, one right over there, you'll find a K1 mu, and the next one is a K2 mu, but then the next term will have a K3 mu, and so on and so forth. It's all the different possible ways of contracting. Now, almost all of what you see on this page is completely useless. It has to do with an artifact of the way we calculate. That's going to be the point.
Was this calculation done by hand?
Oh, no, it was done by form. Oh, no. You got a Dutchman to write a computer program to do that. No fooling around.
Feynman did this?
No, this is Ramazarin's program, but this is the style of, it's like Schoonship, but this was done in form. I mean, that's how you do it before breakfast, right? You have your computer program do it for you. Okay? Okay, so where's the problem? So, What the claim is that the problem has to do with something inherent in Feynman diagrams. That if you look at the Feynman integral, like here's a loop, there's an integral over momentum and over energy. And then you see that the particle that's here, this line here represents a particle, it does not satisfy Einstein's basic relation between energy and momentum. Therefore, it's not a physical particle. Or we could say it differently, this is not a gauge invariant quantity. Individual Feynman diagrams are not physical. Okay? And I don't know about you, but my mother taught me that when you do a calculation, you should do it in terms of physical quantities, not unphysical ones. If you do it in terms of unphysical ones, then you get punished. Okay? So what you need is an on-shell formalism. This is where we're going to go. We're going to try to redo this calculation, rewrite the way that you do the Feynman diagrams in such a way that there's always going to be an equal sign here, that the particles will be physical. But once you start thinking about it a little bit, you start realizing there's a problem with this idea, and it's actually a pretty serious problem. It has to do with the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. Why did the Feynman diagrams do this to us? Why are Feynman diagrams making it so that the energy-momentum relation is not satisfied? And the answer is, it's inherent to Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The way the loop works is I have a particle. I may not have enough energy to create two particles, but that's okay. As long as I do it for a short enough time, then I can violate energy conservation. And that's built into the Feynman integrals. So you could say, oh, look, you can't do it. You have to have the off-shellness. You have to make these things unphysical in order to get the right answer, because it's just part of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And let's call it a theorem. Now, if you know anything about physics, theoretical physics, you'd know if you call something a theorem, it's probably not going to hold. So here's another theorem. This is my favorite one. It says, theorems in physics are bound to be misleading or have major loopholes. So what's the loophole? Well, you see, you got to look carefully at what we wanted. What we want to do is we want to get the correct final answer. We want to reconstruct the complete amplitude using only on-shell input. So the input into the calculation should only be physical quantities. The intermediate step should only be physical quantities. But then at the end, we can go put this off-shell, but just in the last line. So no, it doesn't affect the calculation. That's the key idea. That's how we can sneak past Heisenberg. And here's an example of a modern way of calculating that uses this idea. Now, this is at tree level, so there's no loop, no H-bar, but it's in the spirit that all steps in the calculation only use physical quantities to generate new physical quantities. So the idea is the following. I take some amplitude. This is some amplitude collection of these diagrams you can think of. What I do is I take the momentum and I shift it. So I take a deformation of it, but I do it in such a special way that it remains on shell. So p squared equals zero. This is a four vector. This will be my on shell condition for a massless particle. Okay, and I do it in such a way, I define a vector q in such a way that this massless condition remains and momentum conservation remains. Okay? So it's a construction. Now, this is still a physical quantity. It just happens to have complex momenta. Okay? Now, if you plug this into the amplitude, you're going to get an amplitude that depends on this complex parameter. Right? Now, I don't know about you, but when I see one complex variable z, I want to do Cauchy's theorem. So that's what you do. Now, I'm going to just assume, and this is something that needs to be checked, but it's true, that off at infinity, as z goes to infinity, the amplitude vanishes. And that's something that has to be checked. And it's something that's non-trivial, but it is, in fact, a true statement. But once you have that fact, then from Cauchy's theorem, you immediately get that the amplitude is given by a sum of residues. The residues are given by poles, and the poles have to do with the kinematic poles that are in the amplitude, and in this way you can get what's called the on-shell recursion relation, which is manifestly a construction of a higher point amplitude in terms of on-shell lower loop amplitude. So you're plugging in physical information in here, and here to generate new physical information. And at no step... No, it does not. I'm just picking an example. I don't know. You just have to preserve the on-shell condition. Absolutely. These constructions work in general. You just have to use a different shift. Well, because your period preserving P squared equals zero. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's correct. I guess you'd be using a different Q is the point. Right. You can, but that's not the way it's done. But yeah, okay. Anyway, you just need a Q that has these properties, and you can do your on-shell recursion. And like you say, it definitely works in massive cases. So it's something very general in field theory. So what's really amazing about this is the only thing you put in to this is Cauchy's theorem. And the other thing was very basic facts about the factorization, how amplitudes behave as this intermediate leg goes on shell. And the third thing, that's the non-trivial thing, was right here. If the amplitude vanishes as z goes to infinity. But that's something that you can verify is true.
Is that purely imaginary or just imaginary?
No, it has to be imaginary. You can't... it's complex. These momenta have to be complex. If they're not complex, you can't do this. Okay, so let's now go to loops. Well, this is something we'd worked out quite a long time ago, well before we understood how to do tree level. It's called modern unitarity method, which, of course, I can't explain in any detail. But the basic idea, again, it's a systematic way that you take tree amplitudes. So these blobs here are the tree amplitudes, and you systematically use the different cuts, different ways of putting these particles on shell to assemble an answer, a complete answer that reproduces the Feynman diagrams. And you can do this at loop level. And the point is, it's a systematic construction in the same sense as a Feynman diagram construction is systematic. And the input in here, again, are these on-shell tree amplitudes. And this is something that we like to use now. It's, you could say, the on-shell idea gone crazy, because what we do is we put on-shell legs everywhere, cut everything down to these 3-point, right, and use this as our starting point for trying to reconstruct the amplitude. So every object, every particle you see here, every line here represents a particle, everything is physical. Now, this does not give you the complete answer, but it's a starting point. Then what you have to do is you have to start feeding in these 4-point amplitudes and then 5-point amplitudes in order to reconstruct the entire amplitude. But again, the point is that this is a systematic way of doing things. And this is, in fact, the way we do our high loop calculations. Okay. So that's just a little overview of the technology of how we do things. But now I want to show you harmony. So first, before showing you harmony, let me show you things which are not very harmonious. So here's the Lagrangian of gravity. If you've studied general relativity, you'll recognize this Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. The idea is you take this Lagrangian, you expand the metric in terms of a flat space metric, and then the graviton field. And if you do this expansion, very quickly you get a big mass. You get an infinite number of vertices, starting from the 3-point, 4-point, 5-point, 6-point, and so on. And now let's compare this to the Yang-Mills Lagrangian. This one, you get a 3-point interaction, and then you get a 4-point interaction. This guy is way more complicated than this guy. There's no harmony here, right? In fact, let's look at the 3-point vertices to see how unharmonious it is. the three-point vertex of Yang-Mills is written right here. So these are momenta. There's the flat space metric. There's a color factor. And this is the graviton vertex. This graviton vertex, I'm hiding some of the complexity. P3 means that there you have to do permutations over these different legs, and it generates three terms. Here, if you do those permutations, you generate six terms. Sim means that you have to symmetrize the indices of the graviton. Graviton is a spin-2 field, so it carries two Lorentz indices, and you have to do a symmetrization. You get about 100 terms. So you look here, and you say, that's way more complicated. In fact, if you look at it for just a few more minutes, you'll say, I'm going to go work on a different problem. But I just told you that we should be thinking about on-shell. The problem here, these Feynman vertices, they are not on-shell. Let's think about it on shell. I'm just going to take those same vertices and I'm going to impose the physical state conditions on these different vertices. So gauge theory, well, not so much happens because it was already pretty simple. Plus cyclic means I have a cyclic permutation in there. Let's look at what happens to gravity. When I put the on shell conditions, notice something really spectacular. First, it completely simplifies, but on top of it, it has this squaring relation. It looks just like that. How the hell did that happen? That question I'm not going to answer. I don't know how this happened, but it happens. And in fact, because of these on-shell methods, all of gravity scattering is contained right here. We don't need these infinite numbers of vertices. We don't need these complicated three-point vertices. We use the on-shell recursion, starting from the three-point amplitudes. We build the four-point, we build the five-point, we build all scattering amplitudes. Then what we do is, once we have the tree scattering amplitudes, we feed it into unitarity, and then we can build any loop amplitude. So all information for graviton scattering is right here. So that means I can correct that transparency. That transparency I showed you in the beginning, four transparencies back, that transparency was wrong. First of all of this stuff we cross out because it's completely irrelevant. There's no physical information in it. We can build that S matrix starting from here. Also here in Yang-Mills, this guy was also irrelevant. There's a Ford vertex, but we don't care about that anymore. And the key point is that gravity seems no more complicated than gauge theory, once you look at it this way. And in fact, you do see harmony here. If you go back one transparency, I would say that's pretty harmonious. It's the same vertex, you just get a double copy of it. But it gets better. It's not just the vertices, it's the amplitudes themselves that have some very non-trivial relationships between the gauge theory case, like QCD, and gravity. Okay, these Kawhi-Llewellyn-Tai relations that I've written here, these were derived in string theory. The reason why they were not derived in field theory is, if you start with the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian and the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, you'll never be able to see this. Except if you know the answer already, then you can definitely see it by calculating. But if you didn't know this answer, it's very hard. And in string theory, it's much clearer to see these relations. And then you take the low energy limit, and in the low energy limit we get gravity in terms of gauge theory. So this here is a gravity amplitude, let's say 5 points of gravitons, Einstein-Hilbert. On this side, I have a tree-level amplitude out of Yang-Mills theory. This tree amplitude, it's something called a color-ordered amplitude. It's a it's the coefficient of a certain color factor. So these amplitudes here don't have any color factors in here. So you don't have to ask me the question of what happened to the color factor. It's because I dropped it in writing this relationship. And this is something that holds very generally. Let me really show you a calculation. This is the modern way to calculate a four-graviton amplitude. The key thing is you need to know how to multiply. Right? So you start with a tree amplitude of Yang Mills, and you definitely know this because there's no way you'd be looking at a graviton scattering amplitude unless you already knew the Yang Mills one. So we know these guys. So you write them down, you multiply them, and that's the graviton scattering amplitude. And the great thing is it's even correct. Start with the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, crank it through, and you will find this answer. This is written in terms of what's called spinner helicity. The important thing for you is it's square root of Lorentz inner products. Okay? I'm using the helicity because if I wasn't using helicity, this transparency would not be looking so happy. Okay, let me show you some more harmony. This is a kind of a curious thing. So here's the Yang-Mills vertex again. There's a coupling constant, there's the color factor, and here's again the kinematic factor. Depends on the momenta. These color factors, they're based on a Lie algebra. That's the Lie algebra right there. These are color generators, these are a set of matrices, and you see this FABC appearing here and here in the Yang-Mills theory. That color factor, these generators, they satisfy what's called a Jacobi identity. This here is the Jacobi identity of color. Okay? Now I'm going to do something. I'm going to take the amplitude, and it generated by this set of Feynman diagrams, and I'm going to write it in the following form. The tree amplitude is, okay, there's the coupling constant, there's a numerator factor. So this numerator factor, it came from here, from the kinematics, by feeding it through the Feynman diagram. Then there's a color factor. The color factor is just these FABCs sewn together. So there's a color factor right here. So this NS, that's this S channel. S channel is K1 plus K2 squared. And there's a T channel, there's a U channel. And each one has a different color factor. See, three different color factors. There's a pole. The pole corresponds to this propagator here. And then over here, we have a numerator factor. That numerator factor you get by contracting these indices, and also there's just a small point. There is this diagram here, and what we'll do with this diagram is we'll just throw them into these other ones using this identity. 1 is equal to S over S. So this guy didn't have a pole, so I'll just introduce a pole by hand. There's the pole. And then S, I stick into the numerator. I call that a numerator factor. So here's a curious observation. The color factors, well, they satisfy the Jacobi identity. Here's the Jacobi identity. U-channel color is equal to S-channel color is equal to T-channel color. That's the Jacobi identity. Well, if you check out the numerators, you'll find that the numerators satisfy exactly the same algebra. Now, where the hell did that come from? Well, it's very general. So if we look at higher points, it's I'm just asserting something. Okay? There's no proof.
Yeah, you don't think you can eventually identify it with some algebra?
Yes, but, it's new, so... There definitely will be a much better understanding than me just asserting that this is true. No, we don't have one. In fact, beyond, let's say, 8 points...
It is a bilinear. So what if you just try to interpret it as a Lie algebra? In other words, it's something...
I thought a little bit about it. The place to think about it, I think, is... I'll explain something in a minute, but I think the place to think about this has to do with Kaluza-Klein, because in Kaluza-Klein... When you do the compactification, those kinematic factors become color factors on some appropriate manifold. So I think we can attack it in a certain way, but all this is relatively new. So I'm just going to assert things, that these are like true statements.
On the previous screen, yeah. Is it important that there's that tetrahedral symmetry between the ST and U channels?
No.
Do you think of?
Well, it's important that there's a known shell.
Yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
S plus T plus U is zero.
Yeah. S plus T plus U equals zero is crucial for this. If you take a Feynman diagram where these legs are off shell, this will not be true. Okay. It turns out, and at 4 points, it's only true at 4 points, that if you take Feynman diagrams and you check this, it'll work immediately. You just have to take this guy and throw him into some, it doesn't matter where you throw him, as long as it's consistent. You'll find these relations to be true. Beyond that, it becomes a little more complicated, but the assertion is that there is always a rearrangement at any number of legs, so we'll pick 5. There's 15 diagrams at 5 points, where you rewrite the amplitude as a sum of poles. So these poles are the ones that you would just have with 3-point vertices. Phi cube theory, we would call it in field theory. So these would just be the propagators that you see here with the 3-point vertices. This would be the color factor that you'd write F, 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 A, B, C, F, A, B, C, F, A, B, C. And then this numerator factor you put in to get the right answer. And the claim is, I mean the right answer is the right amplitude. The claim is there is always a rearrangement such that the Jacobi identity, if the Jacobi identity of color is satisfied, the numerator has the same algebra. Okay, you say, well, that's really cute. Now, what are you going to do with this? But first note, yes, harmony. No question about it. The color and the kinematics are singing the same tune. No question about it. They satisfy the same set of equations. Now, there's a few things you can do with this, but let me actually show you something extremely neat of what you can do with this once you observe this. So here is QCD. So this is my non-abelian gauge theory. There's the coupling constant, the color factors, the numerator factors, the denominators. Let's look at gravity. The claim is that the Kawai-Llewellyn tie relations are equivalent to the following statement. If those ends satisfy that color algebra, the Jacobi identity, then the gravity amplitude is given by exactly the same ends, the same numerator factors. Right? This n and that n are the same. Here there's a double copy, and here there's just one copy. Okay, and that was my comment about the compactification. If you think about a compactification, one of these guys will go into that guy. But now you see, it's pretty clear. These guys are singing the same tune. Gravity and gauge theory, scattering amplitudes, the dynamics of it is built out of the same objects.
You can write CIS in terms of the structure constant.
Yes.
Color. Have you tried to write NIS in terms of the structure constant of Lorentz group or something like that?
No. The answer is no. We have not tried very much. Now I have actually a very good excuse here. See, my student is here. This is John Joseph Krosko is back there. Henrik Johansson is the other one. And so we thought, oh, this is really great. We got to write this up. But you see, we're in the middle of a for loop calculation, which I'll tell you about. And there's one thing about for loop calculations. To do it, you got to do it. You start thinking too much about Lorentz groups, then you're not going to do that. So it's just a choice that we decided specifically to put this out of our mind, even though it's a really interesting question.
Why don't you take on more questions?
Here, again, you have to use helicity basis for that?
No, this has nothing to do with helicity at all. This can be written in terms of formal polarization tensors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, dimensional gravity, would you see any extra symmetry?
Excuse me?
If you did this with 3D gravity, would you see any extra symmetry?
Maybe, but there's another important point. This holds in any dimension. This has nothing to do with 4 dimensions in any way.
Well,
so
that gives you a clue, right? If you write a structure constant as SO4, it cannot depend on SO4.
Yeah, it's not a structure constant, not so. It's a matter of A to B to
K. Yeah. Now, there's actually a few reasons, a few things that have to be clarified before going on, you know, to do what you want. These ends, the representations we have that are kind of ordinary looking, they're non-local, actually. I actually wrote it in a way that it makes it look like it's a local object. It's a non-local object, and there's some gauge symmetry in here that, well, I shouldn't call it a gauge symmetry, but there's some kind of symmetry in here that we haven't unraveled. What's that? No, it's some of the ends can be, four. Let's say at 5 points, four of the ends can be taken arbitrarily and they drop out of all amplitudes. So it's like a gauge invariance. Well, the non-locality is the good representations that we've, or the way we've written it, eliminated four of the ends to set them to zero. But as soon as you do that, the poles that should have been there, they get pushed into other ends. That's the non. They can be, or they can be polynomial. We also have representations which are polynomial, but they're more obscure. So there's stuff that needs to be done. Before answering the question of, you know, what's like the grand picture here, there's still cleaning up to do to understand better what exactly these ends are that you won't find in our paper. Okay, so all these fun things, you say, well, okay, that's all very nice, but what are you going to do with it? You know, this on-shell way of looking at things. So let's talk about applications, and let's start with the heavy-duty stuff, which is LHC physics. Okay, so here's just an example of why we need to do these calculations at loop level. I said 5 points is as far as people had gone, and why we have to go higher, let's say to even 7 points. And this is just a very famous example from the Atlas Technical Design Report. This isn't exactly the plot that appeared in there, but it's similar. So in the Atlas Technical Design Report, they had a plot. This is, it's called M effective. Think of it sort of like missing energy, and missing energy is how you would find supersymmetry. But there's a background, and the background comes when a Z boson decays into neutrinos, you get missing energy. So the question is, what's the supersymmetry signal and what's the background? So in the old days they used a program called Pythia. It's a wonderful program, except it doesn't have the correct physics for very hard scattering. We're talking about, there's 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 GeV. Okay, that's serious energy there. This didn't have the right physics. It had only soft physics, not the hard, high-energy physics. A much better program is this leading order program. This is from this paper from Michelangelo Mangano and his colleague, but using this program ALPGEN, it uses leading order matrix elements, meaning it uses tree level. Given, let's say, by the red dots here. And now compare it to the supersymmetry signal. That's the black dot. So this is not real data. This is make-believe data. Based on some model, and you make believe that this is what it'll look like. Okay, so you see what the problem is. Life is not so simple. If you now compare the signal to the background, you're not so certain. And to make matters worse, you have a question: how well do you know that background? Well, I can already tell you the answer. The answer is you don't know it very well. If you want to know it well, this is the calculation you need to do, a next to leading order calculation. So you need to go two legs beyond the current state of the art.
And here's the leading order the same as one loop?
Yes, essentially, except that you have extra radiation. It's one loop is one of the key ingredients to next to leading order. Okay, so let's just see how good this is. Well, what better place to turn to than to data? So this is W plus 2 jets at the Tevatron. Okay, so first we have a plot of theory divided by experiment. So this is the cross-section of theory divided by the cross-section of data. Okay, and if the plot is 1, it means theory and experiment agree perfectly. Okay, if you look at these data points here, you see that, especially at the low end, you're off by a lot, 50%. And then on top of it, you see the blue band That's the uncertainty and the theoretical uncertainty. Now, if you know how these theoretical uncertainties are calculated, you'll know that it's done by voodoo, not by science. So you basically have to make an educated guess. But you see that there's some kind of problem. So the question is this a great discovery? See, theory and experiment don't agree. Well, let's see what next to leading order. You go to the next higher order, you see what it says. And this is from a program called MCFM. And now compare theory to experiment. First, notice the theory is much better, right? That blue band that tells you the error has shrunk. And then on top of it, even better, the theory and experiment are in pretty good agreement. Maybe not out here, but then there's large errors. So there's the perfect example. We go to the LHC, same story. Disagreement between theory and experiment in W plus 3 jets, for example. What does it mean? Well, that's why you need the next to leading order calculations. Okay, here's an example of what the experimenters want. So this is a kind of amusing table here, because this is constructed by experimenters who thought that theorists are infinitely smart and infinitely strong and can do anything. So they just listed everything. And you know, if you look down this list, if you're stuck at 5 points, it's pretty depressing. Okay, now there's no priority in this list. This is basically, if theorists are free, they don't cost any money and they can calculate anything, obviously you want to calculate everything. Now there's a lot of very important processes, like W plus 3 jets, W plus or Z plus 4 jets would be a very good example. Those are the priorities. Okay, so no question about it. If you look down the list of calculations that have been done, almost all the physics comes from Feynman diagrams. There's almost nothing that comes from the modern new techniques that I'm talking about. Two exceptions. One is W plus 2 jets, and the other one is triple vector boson Vs or Ws or Zs, triple vector boson production. But if you now look at what's happened in the field, it's clear where people are heading. It's towards these on-shell techniques, and I'm going to show you why people are heading in this direction. It has to do with the way that the difficulty of the problem scale as the number of legs increases. Okay, so this, I'm going to make a long story short. So there's three groups that are writing computer programs based on these on-shell ideas. This is ours. It's called Black Hat. It's, of course, written in C++, and the key thing is to set it up in such a way that we can do these types of processes. And the input is exactly based on the philosophy of what I told you. You feed it on-shell tree amplitudes, and the output is numerical on-shell one-loop amplitudes. And then you feed this into a phase-based integration program. Now, unfortunately, I can't show you physics today. I can only show you stability, numerical stability. Now, all people who have tried this with Feynman diagrams have failed because of numerical stability issues or because of timing issues. The program is not fast enough. And when I say not fast enough, I just mean it's hopeless. Just no chance of doing it, no matter how much money you had. So what I've got here, it's a plot. This is a relative precision. So if you see a minus 2 here, it means the error is 10 to the minus 2. If you see minus 16, that's an error of 10 to the minus 16. This is plenty good just around here. And this is a distribution on 100,000 phase-based points. The three different plots, that has to do with these things are infrared singularity, so it's kind of chopped up into different components. It's really the blue curve which you keep an eye on. That's where the physics is. The black and the red, you have to calculate them just to make sure that they cancel properly against other contributions. What you see here, you go from 6 to 7 to 8. Watch the timing. It goes 8 milliseconds, 14 milliseconds, 43 milliseconds. It didn't go to 100 trillion, right? So that's why people are interested. That's why people are working on this technique. It offers the promise of not just solving it once, but you just can continue solving it. Okay. But still, like I said, I don't have physics plots to show you. But let me just mention that processes of more interest than just gluons, like vector bosons. We have that under control, and two groups have written papers on that. One is this group of Keith Ellis and his collaborators, and we also did that. Okay, next application. Okay, so in string theory. So for 30 years, since Tuft's paper, we've been dreaming of solving QCD in the planar limit. Well, this is too hard a problem, and the way you know that is it hasn't been solved. Right? So what does a good physicist do? Find another problem that's easier. That's N equals 4 super Yang Mills. That's the easier problem. It's a very supersymmetric theory. It's a much easier problem to deal with. And it's also very important theoretically because of the link to string theory. This ADS-CFT correspondence, Smaldesanus conjecture, is built on N equals 4 super Yang Mills. That CFT is that theory. And what the relationship I'm going to talk about is a precise relationship between scattering amplitudes in this theory and classical string theory in ADS space. But you see, the way that this works is on one side we have this weak coupling, this side we have weak coupling, on this side we have strong coupling. Here you have to sum an infinite number of Feynman diagrams. Okay, I've shown you some fancy technology, but fancy technology or not, you have a little problem that you have to do an infinite number of Feynman diagrams at infinite loop orders. So let me show you how to do it. Well, the key thing is you have to be an optimist. Okay? So let's start with two loops. So you say, okay, let me calculate it. At two loops, we worked it out. We have a high-tech way of doing things on shell. We can calculate very nicely. And then you look at the answer and you observe something. You observe a relationship. You say two loops is the square of one loop plus one loop times some function, which is, this has to do with anomalous dimensions. But anyway, it's some set of numbers that depend only on the dimension. Okay, plus a constant. And then what you say, well, I guess it must be true to infinite orders. So what do you do? Well, you got to be a believer, because why the heck would you do a three-loop calculation unless you believed? So that's what we did. And it works. Then what you do is you say, well, I've got two and three loops understood. Obviously, it must be true to all loop orders. So you just write down the answer.
Any number of legs.
And for any number of legs. Right. So you have to be bold. The other important thing, which I'll explain, is you have to know when to stop your conjectures. Okay, you have to. Excuse me? And for particular helicities, right. Right. So at least we knew to stop there. So the basic idea is you got to be bold in this game, but you have to be bold guided by an understanding of the analytic structure, the analyticity. Right? You can't just make a guess. You need a good reason to guess. And it's the analytic properties that guide us to this guess. So this is an infinite loop order expression. It's in terms of something called a cusp anomalous dimension. And then here is a one loop expression. This one loop expression at 4 points looks like this. And at higher points, it gets more complicated, involving polylogs. And then there's some infrared divergences. So that's some technicality. And then we have our integrability friends. This is really good. So there's this function in here, this anomalous dimension. This is a nice formula, but it can't help you connect to string theory unless you knew what that function is at strong coupling. And that's where our integrability friends come along. They wrote down an integral equation that solves for this. So once we have this, we know to all loop orders the expression, and then what you do is you hope you can find a string theorist strong or smart enough to figure out what to do. Well, generally that's not a problem. So the beautiful paper by Alde and Maldesena, where they confirmed this conjecture for 4 points, by doing a string theory calculation in this anti-de Sitter space. It's a problem like a minimal surface calculation of a soap bubble. It's very similar to that. And just a quick, the good thing is it works. It really does work. So the good news is this led to the discovery of a symmetry which explains the form of the formula for 4 points, also for 5 points. There is a very strong link to this integrability that has to do with infinite number of conserved charges. And the bad news is we didn't know when to stop our guess. At 6 points, if you go back, you may have noticed, like David, wanted to rub in to me, that the n here is n points, and the guess does not work for 6 points. But I think if we look here at the integrability and try to make use of this extra information, it may be possible. Maybe I should be more cautious now. May be possible to fix this and solve for this amplitude with any number of legs, any helicities, and so on. Last topic. Okay, just 5 minutes. So, is an ultraviolet divergent property, theory of gravity, possible? So here's the standard argument that says it's impossible. You can't do this. It's very simple. It's just dimensional analysis. Newton's constant is dimensionful. Since it's dimensionful, it carries more momenta on each vertex. It's as simple as that. Since it has more momenta on the vertices, as you integrate the loop momenta, then what happens is this integral is worse behaved compared to gauge theory because it has more momenta up there. So as you integrate, it's a worse behaved integral. And that's the basic argument that people have used. You can get very sophisticated, use fairly complicated superspaces, and all sorts of sophisticated reasoning, but the bottom line is always this: dimensionful coupling, more powers of loop momenta. Now, we're going to be looking at a special theory. It's called N equals 8 maximally supersymmetric gravity. The reason why we like this is because supersymmetry is good for taming ultraviolet divergences. If you're going to pick a theory, this is the one to pick. But also, what's very important is that the high symmetry of the theory implies technical simplicity. That means we can calculate very far and we can see what's going on. In fact, there's an amusing conjecture from Nima Arkani-Hamed that this N equals 8 supergravity might be the very simplest quantum field theory in four dimensions. Had someone said that, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago, the people would have just laughed. It's completely absurd. But in fact, if you think about this, if it's not right, it's almost right. It's certainly a very simple theory as these theories go, which is very surprising. You know, if you're thinking about Lagrangians. Let me just put up a disclaimer so I don't have to answer questions I'm sure I'll get, which is, why are we looking at this theory? And the answer has to do with symmetry. If the theory is finite, it's not an accident. It's because there's a symmetry in the theory that people have missed. We want to know what that symmetry is, or this mechanism, some kind of non-trivial mechanism. Clearly, understanding such a symmetry would be crucial. It's something I think there's no question that it's would be something really important for understanding the structure of gravity. Now let's see what people from the 80s said. So here's a typical opinion. The reason why I'm picking the 80s is, roughly speaking, nothing happened on this topic since the 80s. During the 80s, this was a topic which a lot of attention was focused on, whether you can make, let's say, N equals 8 supergravity or other supergravity theories finite. And everybody, just about everybody, there were a few exceptions, but just about everybody said it would diverge at 3 loops. And here's a nice quote you can see, unfortunately, in the absence of further mechanisms for cancellation, the analogous N equals 8, D equals 4 supergravity theory would seem to diverge at 3-loop order. Okay, so you say, well, gee, is this statement true? Now, I'm not going to go into it, but there are actually some really good reasons why you want to re-examine this, why you don't want to take this at face value. It has to do with our ability to use this unitarity method to look to very high loop orders very easily. And very quickly, you can see a set of cancellations, and you start wondering whether these cancellations are general or not. But maybe before jumping to the calculation, what would happen to you if you tried this with Feynman diagrams? You get about 10 to the 20th terms in just this one diagram. You don't have to worry about the other 100 trillion diagrams. Just this one will kill you. Okay. So no one has done it from Feynman diagrams because you can't even begin. So let me just jump to the answer because I'm almost out of time. So using the modern methods, the on-shell ideas, we sat down and we did the calculation. And the answer is, three loops, not only is it ultraviolet finite, we call it superfinite. You find even stronger cancellations beyond those needed for finiteness. So what they said in the 80s was not correct. And we know that for a fact, because we calculated it. Now, we're trying to unravel what's going on here. We've tried thinking about how to prove this to all loop orders, but pretty soon you get confused for various reasons. So when you get confused, you calculate. These are my superheroes, Carrasco and Johansson. They like doing high loop supersymmetric calculations. Okay, we have n equals 4 super Yang mills. The calculation is complete. And this n equals 8 is in progress. And this for loop is going to certainly teach us a lot. At the very least, we're going to exchange bottles of wine depending on what the answer is. So this is Kelly Stell. Says that the bet, if you're curious, it has to do with five dimensions. So the question is, in five dimensions, does this diverge or not? Okay. Now you say, okay, that's very very nice, but you know, you have infinite number of loops. I'm almost done. You have infinite number of loops. So this is diminishing returns, right? Tell me about infinite number of loops, because finiteness doesn't have to do with three loops, four loops, five loops. It's infinite loops. Well, we can't answer the question of infinite numbers of loops right now, but we can peer to infinite number of loops like a searchlight, that you look at a restricted set of terms. And by looking at the restricted set of terms, indeed it's true, you do find the superfiniteness condition. The theory we find based on a limited analysis is that it's going to be finite in dimensions less than 6 over L, L is the loop number, plus 4. So it's always going to be finite in four dimensions. Now, we just emphasize this is not a proof. It's only based on a partial analysis. But at least we know that there's something going on here, right? We are sure there is something going on here. We don't know if it implies finiteness or not. So the summary is that we have these powerful methods, these on-shell methods, which are a powerful alternative to Feynman diagrams. There are remarkable structures to uncover. I showed you just a few. I just picked a couple things to show you. One is this funny relationship between color and kinematics, very intriguing. There's a lot more to be done to unravel that. This notion that gravity is the square of gauge theory. It's something you'd never guess in a million years from looking at the Lagrangians, but it's true if you look at the scattering amplitudes. And there's this, in general, this remarkable harmony between gravity and gauge theory. But all this nice stuff, what you want also are applications. So I showed you the three applications to QCD. So a lot of people are spending a lot of time now writing the computer programs to do these high multiplicity calculations next to leading order. There's in n equals 4 supersymmetric gauge theories. By looking at the scattering amplitudes, we've opened a new venue for studying this ADS-CFT correspondence of Maldacena. And then in quantum gravity, there's this question, is it possible to build a point-like ultraviolet theory of quantum gravity? And the evidence suggests, we have concrete evidence suggesting that it's true, but certainly we have no proof. So I'd like to finish there, but before I finish, I got to show you something, some amusement. Okay, so go to YouTube, search Big Bang. Big Bang is a sitcom, Big Bang Theory. I don't know how many of you watch TV, but okay. And then DMV, and click on the first hit. Let me show you what you get.
Could you enlarge it?
It gets fuzzy. I think we'll...
Yeah, I gotta ask, why didn't you just get a license at 16 like everybody else?
I was otherwise engaged.
Doing what?
Examining perturbative amplitudes in N equals 4 supersymmetric theories, leading to a re-examination of the ultraviolet properties of multi-loop N equals 8 supergravity using modern twistor theory.
Next! Application?
I'm actually more of a theorist.
Okay, there you go. Yes.
Have you systematically incorporated the unitarity constraints?
Yeah, definitely. The whole construction is designed in such a way that unitarity works. And absolutely. Now this builds, it's called the unitarity method for a good reason. The unitarity constraints are built into there. We use in doing the constructions, we do use something more general, something called generalized unitarity. But if you take our final answers, they just manifestly have unitarity constraints. Absolutely. But it's really fundamental to the way we think about it.
Other questions? Yes.
Do you get anything if you cube gauge theory?
Good question.
Yeah, it'd be some kind of spin three field theory, and no one knows how to build something like that, at least consistent, except in string theory where you put in an infinite number of other fields.
You got to remove the color.
Yeah. You have. Yeah. Certainly no one knows how to make such a theory consistent.
Since the perturbative expansion for the Feynman integral starts diverging at order 1 over the coupling constant, right, why are you interested in these infinite loop questions?
Oh, it turns out N equals 4 super Yang Mills has a finite radius of convergence.
The planar limit.
I maybe the word planar was somewhere, but I didn't say it explicitly. But those in the N equals 4 super Yang Mills case, those infinite loop order expansions are planar, and there is a finite radius of convergence, and people even know what that radius of convergence is. I mean, it's in fact the only way that you can make a connection. If that wasn't true, would there be no way you could take our infinite loop order expression and then you go over to string theory, ignoring any other non-perturbative effects, and make it match? So it's inherent to the fact, you could say the reason why this works is because the non-perturbative effects are trivial in this case. So that is actually very special. Yeah.
At one point you mentioned that you could map your conjecture onto some integral equation, right? Does the integral equation look reasonably simple?
Or which conjecture?
It's only for the
cusp anomalous dimension. It's actually a very beautiful equation.
Is it known to mathematicians or others?
People have certainly solved it extremely well numerically, and also in expansions of weak coupling, expansions of strong coupling. So that equation is understood pretty well.
Other questions? Well, let's thank the speaker for this beautiful talk.